Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. It was French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre who said, "Hell is other people." And while psychologists have long disagreed with that, new research is now telling us just how important our relationships are to our survival. They're just as critical as diet, exercise, earning power, and stress management. Today, we'll explore the village effect and the importance of face-to-face connections with award-winning author, developmental psychologist, and journalist Susan Pinker. And that's coming up in the second half of today's show. But first, trend pundits used to say 50 was the new 40. Well, now they're saying 60 is the new 40 and 70 the new 50. But what does that mean to boomers? Boomers, as we know, are retiring healthier than any previous generation. And what does that mean for their families? What does it mean for their communities? Well, we're going to explore that with founder and director of the Center for Conscious Eldering, Ron Pevney. He received his master's in integral counseling and psychotherapy from the California Institute of Integral Studies. He's a certified saging leader with Saging International and the creator of the 15 Organization Conscious Aging Alliance. And Ron is probably familiar to some of you here on KKNW. He conducts workshops and retreats across North America and at various venues such as Earthrise and Ghost Ranch in New Mexico. Ron Pevney, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you, Vicki.
And we're pleased to have you, Ron. Your book is called Conscious Living, Conscious Aging, Embrace and Savor Your Next Chapter. And you say it's written for boomers who are nearing 60 and those who are older, but I really think, you know, anybody who's concerned about consciously aging and consciously living, even if for just our parents, this would be a book for them to read. And I read that your passion or the calling for the work that you do is fueled by your retreat attendants. They have, you say, an urgency to answer the big question about aging and what they're aiming for as they age. So tell us how you started doing this kind of work, Ron.
Well, for many years, probably 30, 35 years, my work, my passion, my sense of calling has been helping people move through life transitions and to understand and to work with those dynamics that happen in all of us, whether we're aware of them or not, as we move through life transitions. And I guess about 15, 16 years ago, the subject of aging began to come on my radar screen. I'm 66 now. At that time, I was in my early 50s. I began doing a lot of video-based oral history work with older adults in my community here in Durango. And I began to be fascinated with talking with these people about their lives. And I began to ask myself some questions as I was with these people. Like, why is it that some people as they age seem to just have a light in their eye, a spark, an optimism, a curiosity, a joy, you know, really looking toward the future?
Mm-hmm.
And other people seem to, it's like they've been beaten down by life, the spark is gone, oftentimes cynical, don't seem to have a joy, and really seem to be living in the past. Just kind of hanging on to who they have been for as long as possible without much in the way of goals or any kind of excitement for the future. And in many ways, those questions have propelled me as I have learned from some people I consider truly wise and alive elders, as I've learned from my own experiences, and I have certainly learned from the many people who've been on our workshops and retreats, who are in many ways asking those same questions. Who do I want to be as I age, and how can I become that kind of a person?
Right. I want to talk about the sparkle in the eye there. I remember, many years ago now, interviewing Hazel Wolf, who was very well known up here as an environmentalist. She was 101. And unfortunately, she died 5 days after I interviewed her. Nothing to do with me. But I do remember looking at her and thinking how vibrant she was. And she had this incredible sparkle in her eye, which, you know, I definitely attributed to her 101 years on this planet. And wouldn't it be great if you could, you know, you said you look at the people who have the spark and the people who don't. Wouldn't it be great if you had an answer that we could fix that? But is there a commonality amongst those who do have the sparkle and do continue to age well?
Well, I think that the commonality that I have certainly begun to see and understand, and that I think is very much the topic of my book, is that those who age really well tend to be people who have, for one thing, they've paid attention to their inner lives. They have been conscious in many ways about who they are, rather than just kind of operating on automatic, moving through life. They seem to be people who are not carrying a lot of old baggage from the past that can certainly tie up our energy and disempower us. They're people who don't seem to be holding on to all kinds of regrets, resentments, feelings of, you know, I have been wounded by life, but rather people who have learned to accept that life is about change, life is about losses, and with every loss there's a possibility for new beginnings. I think it's people who really have worked to make sure they're not carrying a lot of baggage with them into their older chapters, because mm-hmm. that baggage really does, it drains the light out of our eyes. I think it drains our joy. It drains our energy.
Yeah, I know from talking with many scientists, neuroscientists, that they say resilience is one of the absolute key factors in living a fulfilled and satisfied life, and that has a lot to do with it.
Yes.
I want to ask you about aging as a number, because I remember when my great aunt turned 80 and I asked her how she felt, she said, "Oh, inside, I still feel 19. And, you know, I've talked with many people who've said the same thing. The number may vary, but they still feel a fraction of their age. And yet in my work, and I'm sure probably in your work too, I often see women that are torn between proudly embracing and exclaiming their age and simultaneously wanting to hide it, because society does like to categorize people. They do like to put labels on people. What do you say to people in that situation?
Well, I think that a lot of us, as we age, and a lot of baby boomers for whom some of these are dynamics are becoming realities now, feel torn in that particular situation. Yeah, you're certainly right that we have a society that does not. A society that is obsessed with youth, a society that does not honor aging, does not have any kind of a meaningful role for people as they reach, you know, retirement age or thereabouts, that basically holds older people as being irrelevant. And so that is painful, and many people do not want that. They don't want to see themselves or be seen as irrelevant. They want more, but I think most people are not yet clear on what that more can possibly be. And there is the reality that you mentioned, that we are able to live longer and live healthier. And so a great many of us have a more youthful energy and vigor, you know, when we're in our 60s and 70s than perhaps our parents or grandparents did when they were even younger than that. But I think an important point I make in my book is that, you know, while in terms of energy and vigor and perhaps a certain youthfulness, you know, 70 could be the new 50 or 60, the new 40 or whatever, mm-hmm. I do not think it serves any of us to just because we have more energy and vigor to try to pretend that we're 40 forever.
Right.
Because there are certain developmental stages in the development of our psyches, certain life stages that really call to be honored. And the stay stage that comes after midlife adulthood is a stage that really has its particular tasks and challenges. It really calls us to be more reflective, to go within more, to focus more on the kind of person we are and we become, on being, rather than just on the stuff we do, which is what so much of the younger ages are about, especially in our society.
Right, right.
And so people are feeling torn, but many people do realize that there is something more empowering out there that's possible beyond the mainstream messages we get from our society about aging.
Well, I know you've spent years co-creating and co-guiding rites of passage retreats into conscious elderhood, and that's a good segue for us to go into that. But we need to take a quick break first, and so we'll talk about that and a couple of the other things I pulled from your book when we come back. My guest in this segment is Ron Pevney. His book is called Conscious Living, Conscious Aging, Embrace and Savor Your Next Chapter, and we'll talk about rites of passage when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net.
Joining us next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, literary journalist Gail Sheehy, author of 16 books, including the classic New York Times bestseller, Passages, named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books of our time. One of the original contributors to New York Magazine, she has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. She shares stories from her new memoir, Daring, My Passages, next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
There's no regrets, no tears to cry. I don't want you back.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, and Eric's playing that song, and it always makes me want to cry. I don't know why. That guy has such a fabulous voice. It's Scott Walker, right? Such an incredible voice. But we're talking about conscious living and conscious aging today. Ron Pevney's new book, that's what his new book is called, Conscious Living, Conscious Aging. And it's all about embracing and savoring the next chapter in life. And I wanted to lead into, from what we were talking about before the break, Ron, I want to lead into rites of passage, because I know you put on retreats and you spent many, many, many years, and your book talks about rites of passage into conscious elderhood. Why do you believe, I guess my questions around this are, why do you believe these rites of passage are important, that it's important to actually have an official rite of passage, if you will? And also along those lines, since so many things happen, probably more so in elder life because we lose more people, there's more change going on, do we need more than one rite of passage?
Well, throughout history, most societies that we know of really recognized and honored the process of life transition. and those inner dynamics that happen as we move from one life stage to another. And society's created and used rite of passage experiences as a way of really helping to mark and honor and understand and work with the dynamics of the transition process. And when you work with them, and there really is a three-stage dynamic that begins with assessing and carefully looking at the chapter that is ending and letting go of that which was part of that chapter but that isn't going to serve us moving forward. Then there's an in-between time when we're not who we have been, but we're not who we're becoming either, kind of a time that can feel oftentimes lost and adrift as we're waiting the seeds of new beginnings to gestate in us. And then there is that stage then when we're actually beginning to move, you know, with some sense of clarity into the next chapter. And so societies have long understood that if you work with each of those dynamics, then it helps people to move in a good, clear way from one stage to another. A big loss, I think, in our modern world, you know, probably since the dawn of the industrial age, has been that we have lost touch with the natural rhythms and cycles around us in the natural world. I mean, right. Look at the terrible state that our environment's in, thanks to us, and we've lost touch with those rhythms and cycles in ourselves. And so being aware of those dynamics and then finding some way to mark them can be incredibly important. And not everybody's going to go through some kind of a rite of passage experience like we offer in our retreats. But for people to at least be consciously working with dynamics, they can help to take themselves through the process of transition and, in effect, create their own rite of passage type of experience.
Mm. I want to ask you about a dream that you wrote about in your book. You say the essence of that dream was no regrets. You can have no regrets and you must teach no regrets. That was the essence of your dream. And you write that in your dream you were told you can only teach no regrets if you truly understand and are able to live without regrets. I want to talk about this because, you know, I often hear people say, oh, I don't have any regrets, and I really don't believe that. I think we have to acknowledge what's gone wrong, and, you know, I think most of us would have had do-overs at some point in our life if we had a second chance.
Sure.
But it's all about understanding, you know, the regret. So talk to us a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, that dream was probably one of the most significant dreams and most significant learning experiences of my life. It really, really has catalyzed a whole lot of searching to understand some important things about how we can move forward from the past without being stuck. And for many people, one of the most disempowering things they carry with them as they age is regret. And for people who work in hospice, they'll tell you that for many people on their deathbed, these regrets that just kind of gnaw away at them and they just hold on to keep so many people from having any kind of peace in their final days and hours. What I have come to learn, and I still have more to learn, I am sure, about understanding this and about living it. But what I've come to learn about regrets is that we're all going to have regrets. There are things we wish we would not have done that we did. There are things we wish we would have done that we didn't do. They're going to be regrets. And whenever we are aware of those, being human, they're going to cause us, you know, a bit of pain, you know, because there is that sense of sorrow mm-hmm. that perhaps it could have been different. But, and this is the big one, what's important is not that we try to get rid of regrets, because as long as we're human, there's going to be some of that. What's important is how we hold those or how we relate to those. And there are many people, including myself most of the time, that can look at experiences that and see these as real, in a way, gifts. I mean, these were experiences through which we learned, through which we grew that helped the kind of person we are now. And that's really an empowering story of all the events of our lives. There are other people who look at their regrets and they use them to continually beat themselves up and to feed these stories that, well, I am unworthy, or I've been a victim all my life, or I am unlovable, and this thing I'm regretting or that thing is just further evidence of this miserable story about myself. And that is what I believe that we can change and transform. It does none of us any good to beat ourselves up, to not forgive ourselves because of things that we regret. It
Right.
does us a lot of good if we can adopt that, if we can get to that place where at least a lot of the time we can see our lives as a hero's journey, that wonderful myth of what it means to be human that Joseph Campbell so popularized. And the hero's journey, a way of looking at our lives, is not just that our lives are a bunch of stuff that has happened, but that everything that has happened has been an opportunity for growth, or it can be an opportunity to somehow learn, an opportunity to somehow move forward. And without these opportunities, we might not well have the wisdom and the insight and perhaps the compassion that we have now.
Right. I love that you write in the book. Well, first of all, you write Jean Houston, who also wrote a lot on the hero's journey along with Joseph Campbell, of course. Jean Houston wrote, "It provides us, the hero's journey, with a template that allows us to open ourselves to the head and create potentials and deepen knowing that transcends past, present, and future." And you write, and I love this, then, if we understand the hero's journey, I'm paraphrasing here, you say, then our passage through life can be best understood as a highly meaningful journey involving sorrow and joy, loneliness and community, endings and beginnings, experience and learning, all toward the fulfillment of our unique human potential. We need all of those things, those peaks and valleys, if you will.
Yes, we do indeed. And you know, in all the world's wisdom traditions, it's understood that there is, you know, some version or other of the wounded healer. Those who are most in touch with the gifts they have to give to the world and who can make the biggest difference are those who have been wounded themselves, either by others or by their own actions or inactions, but those who have taken those wounds and learned from them and grown from them.
Right.
I think if we could all work to see our lives as a hero's journey, that reframes so many of our experiences and how we relate to so many of them.
Right. And I think the important thing with that hero's journey, we may have several of those going on in different areas of our life at any one time.
Yes.
So we only have a couple of minutes left here, literally, Ron. So I wanted to just follow on from the power of myth, the importance of the hero's journey, and talk about building a legacy, the importance of building a legacy. You discuss this in the book. So in a minute or so, can you just summarize the importance of leaving a legacy?
Yeah, there are two aspects to legacy, as I outline in the book. And one is the legacy that we have created up to now in our lives. But the other is the legacy we have yet to create in our later chapters. And so many people, when they get toward retirement age, think, well, basically my legacy's behind me. Whatever I have to create has been created. But if we could see these years, you know, 20, 30 years for many of us after retirement age, as an opportunity to build a beautiful legacy of growth, of ripening into the fullness of our potential as human beings, of service to our communities, of helping to make this a better world so that our children and our descendants can have a livable world to live in. If we look at these years as a year of reaching the fullness of our legacy, and we look forward that way and we approach these years with intention and with focus rather than just kind of drifting along, I think that we can all leave wonderful, wonderful legacies.
Yeah. And I just want to share this because I was talking with my nephews and nieces a little while ago about my mother who's passed away. But I said, what are your fondest memories of your grandmother? And they said when she used to tell us bedtime stories, but she never read from a book. She would tell stories of when she was a little girl and of her mother. And those are the times and the stories that they most appreciated and most remember. So it's important to share our legacy through that storytelling.
I love that. That's right. Our legacy doesn't have to be about big actions in the world, even though for some people as we age, they can be visible. It can just be being with grandchildren with incredible presence and love, like in the case that you're talking about. But doing what we do with presence and love and consciousness and not just kind of automatically moving through our days.
Right. Well, a final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with, Ron. I know they listeners can find out more about you at book.centerforconscious.eldering.com. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I believe that all of us, as we age, can and should aim much higher than we do. So many of us aim low. So many of us don't aim at all. But if we aim high, if we aim for our best, if we're willing to step outside of our comfort zone some and believe that incredible years can lie ahead of us, what a difference it can make for us and what a difference it can make for the world around us.
Love the work you're doing. Thank you so much, Ron Pevney, for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicki.
And again, you can find out more about Ron and the work that he's doing and his book at book.centerforconscious.eldering.com. And the book is Conscious Living, Conscious Aging. Embrace and savor your next chapter. Coming up next, why would a weekly meal with friends add as many years to your life as quitting smoking? Well, we'll find out shortly. So stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
The final curtain, my friend. I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets I've had a few, but then again too few to mention.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Whispering Dragon in Seattle, we cover the world of animals. This week, November 2nd, it's a shelter, rescue, sanctuary, and anything that helps our animal friends Sunday, and a behavior training and healing Sunday. I'll be in the studio and catch up with all my favorite rescues and sanctuaries, plus I'll open phone lines for any behavior training or healing questions you have about your animal friends. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, I'm Charlie. I fight fires and I save lives.
My name's Renee. I'm a cardiologist. I save lives.
My name's Anthony. I'm an EMT. I save lives.
You don't have to be a professional to save a life. Firefighters, doctors, and others save lives. You can too. Don't wait. To learn more about the warning signs and how you can help prevent suicide, visit save.org. In a crisis, call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you at the exact level you need. Whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Susan Pinker. She's a developmental psychologist, columnist, and broadcaster who writes about social science. Her first book, The Sexual Paradox, was published in 17 countries and awarded the William James Book Award by the American Psychological Association. Her work's been featured in the New York Times, the Globe and Mail, the Times of London, BBC, CBC, the list is endless here. And she lives in Montreal, somewhere I'm actually dying to visit. So I'd like to welcome to the show Dr. Susan Pinker. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
And your book is called The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And I heard that the idea for this book came to you in 2008 while you were sitting at a dark Toronto auditorium, and you first heard of a far-off place where men live as long as women, and it sparked something in you. So tell us how that led to this book.
Well, it started from my last book, Vicki, when I was really fascinated by the fact that all over the world, men live shorter lives than women, about 5 to 7 years less, pretty much everywhere where women don't die in childbirth. All developed nations, there's this lifespan gap. And I wondered what was behind it. And I did have some inkling that, for example, we know that people who have wider social networks, who go out to see friends, were less likely to suffer from dementia. So I had some clues there. But it was only in that auditorium when I heard there's one place where men live as long as women, and it's also a place where there are 10 times as many centenarians as we have in North America, that I thought, I have to go there and find out what's going on.
And you put this book together. I mean, you did intensive interviews. You did intensive research. You looked particularly at the field of social neuroscience, which is, I believe, the fastest emerging form of neuroscience right now. Talk to us a little bit about how that's different and what it's looking at.
Well, social neuroscience is the study of the way our brains and bodies affect our actions and relationships in the real world, and the reverse, how our relationships have an impact on the functioning of our brains. And it's a fairly new field because it's only really developed as MRIs and fMRIs have become more affordable and more accessible. So we can measure such things as brain functions while people are interacting with each other. And it's also much more, interesting to us now, because what used to be considered a soft science, meaning the science of how people relate to each other, has actually become a hard science because we now have some neurological evidence behind it.
And an important science based on the findings that they're bringing back to us.
Exactly. And that also sparked this book because it was not only this sense that there's something behind the fact that women live longer lives and also more connected lives as a rule than men, but we were starting to have evidence of how and why this works in terms of, for example, our measures of hormonal, the release of hormones when we interact with people. So we know now, for example, that when women reach out to other people to give them assistance or support, oxytocin is released in the helper. So the helper feels good, her stress is damped down, and she is also better able to solve problems. So it's not just the person being helped who benefits, but the person who reaches out that who benefits.
Right, and that oxytocin is really important because that's the same hormone that's released when mothers are nurturing their babies, right?
Exactly, and its first cousin, vasopressin, is the hormone that's released during pair bonding, meaning that when animals mate and what we call fall in love, they make a commitment often to stay together, and vasopressin is the hormone that allows that to happen. It allows two members of the same species to bond and stick together.
Right. So in I opened this segment or ended the last segment with, why would a weekly meal with friends add as many years to your life as quitting smoking, a question that you raise. What is the science behind that? And is that an actual measurable statistic there?
It is, actually. And the way that they do it is they take huge populations, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people, they measure everything about their behavior, and then they follow them into the future to see who is most likely to get sick and die. So it's not that mysterious. And essentially, they find out that what's a more powerful predictor of longevity, or who will be alive, say, in the 7.5 to 10 years that they're measuring, that social interaction, it more powerfully predicts survival than who's smoking and who has quit smoking. So, in fact, of all the things that we can control, okay, including whether we live in a polluted place or whether we treat our hypertension or whether we quit smoking or drinking, how much we interact with people in the here and now is the most predictive of our survival. And in fact, people who have active social lives have a 50% survival advantage over those people who are more solitary.
It's quite significant. I mean, very significant. Now, we talked about the importance of getting that oxytocin released. You know, we get that through touch. We get it through face-to-face contact. It's not something we get on Facebook, but is that something we might get through, say, Skyping?
Now, that's a really good question, because there's no evidence yet that we can get that kind of hormonal boost from online interaction, and even something as immediate as Skype. You actually have to have close proximity, as far as we know now. But the research is still emerging, so it could be that as our, you know, online connections become more and more immediate. I mean, who knows? Soon we may be able to not just hear and see people in the here and now, but perhaps smell them, right? Who
right.
knows what's in the future? But right now, for our kind of the hormonal benefits, for cortisol, which is a measure of stress, to be damped down, you actually have to be in the same room with each other.
Mm. Now, according to your book, we know that we, you know, if we send somebody an email that's kind of encouraging, that, you know, people may or may not be affected by that. But there is some significant change if we hear voice. And I've actually found myself lately when, say, my sister or my niece or my brother have called me, I've actually found myself saying, it's really good to hear your voice, and really meaning it. So
yes.
Does that voice have an impact on us? And if so, how?
It does, actually. And I'm going to, with your permission, relate a little study that was done where they compared a group of teenage girls who the experimenters intentionally put under some stress. And then they controlled what kind of contact they had with their mom. So either their mom saw them in the here and now after the stressful event, or that was like one quarter of the group. Another quarter of the group got a phone call from mom. Another quarter of the group got a text, an encouraging text from mom, and another quarter of the group was the control group. They got nothing at all, like nothing from mom. And these were girls who were stressed out by being asked to solve math problems under a time limit in front of an audience. So almost anybody would feel some tension under those circumstances.
Right, right.
Then they compared what happened to the levels of cortisol in these girls' saliva, and that's a direct biological measure of how much stress they were experiencing at that moment. So they had the measure before the test, and after the test, and then after the interaction. So what they found was that the cortisol reduced the most after face-to-face contact with mom. Then it reduced at the next level after voice contact with mom through the telephone. But what was most surprising is that text contact had no effect on cortisol levels. Text contact was exactly the same as nothing.
Mm, so they could be equally as stressed out after the text as they were before.
Exactly. And most of us think that communication modes are all the same. You know, if you send a text to somebody saying, you know, I'm with you all the way, or, you know, give it all you've got, or I'm thinking of you, we think and conflate it with a phone call, but it's not at all the same.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you say that in 1985, Americans had an average of 3 confidants. By 2004, they averaged fewer than 2, and we're 10 years later now, so I'm guessing that number's even lower. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll look at that and look at that how that is impacting us. My guest is Dr. Susan Pinker. Her book is The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And you're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
My understanding, it's not your fault. I was being too demanding. I must admit, it's my pride that made me distant. All because I hoped that you'd be someone different. There's not much I know about you. Fear will always make you blind. The answer is in clear view. It's amazing what you'll find face to face.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Joining us next week on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, literary journalist Gail Shee, author of 16 books, including the classic New York Times bestseller, Passages, named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books of our time. One of the original contributors to New York Magazine, Shee has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. She shares stories from her new memoir, Daring, My Passages, next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
If you'd like to advertise your business or service on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, or you'd like to become a program supporter by sponsoring one of our shows, please call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine a spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772 or email info@conversationslive.net. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair has a new Facebook page, so you can see what's happening on our show and what we're up to between shows. Like us on Facebook and look out for upcoming contest drawings.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
Just to leave this unresolved. It's not hard to go the distance. When you finally get involved face to face.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my guest in this segment is Dr. Susan Pinker. She's an award-winning author, developmental psychologist, and journalist. And we're talking today about her new book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter. And Susan's been sharing some of the information gathered from social neuroscience, which I think is the fastest emerging neuroscience out there right now, people, you know, looking at the long-term effects and short-term effects of technology, for one thing, right, Susan?
Right.
And so I said before the break, in 1985, Americans had an average of 3 confidants. By 2004, they averaged fewer than 2. You know, we're 10 years on now, so we've got to guess that's probably less. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you know, I think that there are a whole bunch of factors involved with that. We're a really mobile society, aside from being a very hyper-connected society, meaning connected online. But we also move around a lot. And the more connected we've become, yet we've never been lonelier. I would say that I would call the age that we're in now as the age of loneliness. You know, we used to have, you know, the Bronze Age, and we had the Automotive Age, and so on. And now I think we have the Loneliness Age, because many people have just one person they can depend on, and it's their spouse, and often that's men. In other words, they have their wife or their girlfriend, and that's the one person they can confide in, and if they don't have that one person, they have no one.
Yeah. Now, I talked with Dr. Lewis, who's a British researcher in the field of actually marketing neuroscience, but you know, there's a lot of crossover there a little while ago. And he said that we get addicted. We have this feeling when we are, say, on Facebook or Twitter or email, and we've got new stuff coming in because it releases serotonin in the brain. And so we get this temporary, it's a very temporary feeling of, oh, you know, somebody's paying attention to me or whatever, because of the release of serotonin. But it's very quickly gone, and it's really leaves people quite devoid at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I see it the way junk food is designed, to give us a quick hit of salt and sugar, and then we come back for more.
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it.
Yeah, so in fact, there's something very appealing and attractive about it, and it's addictive because it feels good when you get that ping, like somebody wants to be in touch with me, and who knows what kind of news this could be. It could be great news. Often it isn't, right? But at the end of the day, because we're not getting the sustenance of being together, touching each other, that little pat, that little handshake, that little high five, all those small things which we think are invisible actually have an impact on our mood. And so there's something that people have called Facebook depression, which I think comes from a couple of sources. I think one is that people use Facebook to advertise what they want to say about themselves and kind of craft a perfect persona for a public consumption. So they don't usually talk about the things that are going wrong or their disappointments. They only talk about their triumphs and achievements. So it gives the impression to other people, and there are many people lurking on Facebook, that everybody else's life is perfect but theirs.
Right, right.
And that's one source, I think, of a depressed mood. And another source of the depressed mood of Facebook is, as I said, you don't get that kind of boost that comes from being with a real person in the here and now. Because after all, we're a social species. I mean, non-human primates, like baboons, for example, or chimpanzees, they spend 45% to 50% of their waking hours engaged in one-to-one social interactions, so did we until very recently. And now we spend a maximum of 20% of our time with other people. And so there's a huge reduction in what people have very facilely called face time. But actually, we need that face-to-face time. And the third aspect of why sometimes it's depressing to have only online contact is that it sometimes fills a gap in our time, that people turn to Facebook when they're feeling low already or when they have nothing else to do, kind of like television. So you're already not feeling that great when you look at Facebook, some of us, and then the Facebook just reinforces that. It's as if it makes us more, it sort of exaggerates what's already there.
Yeah.
And that's why I call it the rich get richer, poor get poorer phenomenon with online interaction.
Right.
It's great for people who are really outgoing, upbeat, cheerful, have lots of friends, and use the medium to connect with other people in person. It's often not good for people who have difficulty interacting face-to-face, who may be shy or introverted, who don't get out much for various reasons, or who have some kind of social disability, for example, or on the autistic spectrum. What we know about online connection is it does not reduce people's loneliness.
Makes sense. It makes perfect sense to me. I want to ask you very quickly, because we've only got a few minutes left here and I have a couple of questions I want to try and squeeze in. But you raise the question of, you call it the Elizabeth Edwards question. Does facing hardship or thinking negative thoughts really cause cancer? Does maintaining a sunny disposition while trying to lead a stress-free life prevent it? And you say the answer to both questions is no. There's no good scientific evidence that stress causes cancer, even though studies have repeatedly tried to establish the connection.
Yes, and I think there are two things going on, Vicki. I think that when people face a life-changing event, say a cancer diagnosis, because the human brain is made to look for cause and effect, what I call the ping pong of cause and effect, we often look back and say, what happened in my past to bring this on? When in fact it could have been a random genetic event. But it's very hard for us as humans to absorb that it was just chance that did this terrible thing to us. As there's a very well-known psychologist and biologist, Robert Sapolsky at Stanford, who says that, you know, when you get a cancer diagnosis, you're more likely to remember a stressful event than when you get the diagnosis of a bunion. So something life-changing causes us to look back and say, oh, it must be that. But there's absolutely no evidence that that is true. Stress does not cause cancer. Thinking happy thoughts does not protect us. It may make us feel better in the here and now, but in terms of protecting our health, there's no evidence that it has that kind of effect.
Mm. So I want to look at creating the village effect. So, you know, this book is really well written and packed full of great information and, you know, very heavily researched and information provided, you know, based on that research. So what is it we can do ourselves? A couple of tips off the top of your head there, because we only have a couple of minutes here. How can we start creating a village effect for ourselves? The first one, obviously, is to reduce our time online and create more face-to-face contact. But how do we make this happen?
I think there are a lot of very simple things that we can do, and I've done them myself, because as I researched this book, it started to change my own habits. So many of us now, because we know that exercise is really good for us, we plan it into our day. We structure it, like this is where I'm going to work out or go to the gym or do my running, for example. And I would suggest that we see social contact the same way, that you have to have some every day or you're not going to feel well and you're not going to be well. So, you know, one of the things that I've done is that I've combined my exercise with social contact so that instead of swimming laps alone in the pool during free swim time, I joined a swim team so that I see the same people three times a week, and we've built a community and relationships around that. The other thing is that if you're looking for a place to live, make sure that you focus not just on the size of your closets or how many spaces in your garage, but do you know your neighbors? Is this a cohesive community where people know each other? Is there a sidewalk? Can they meet each other? Do they talk to each other? Are there places where they can gather? This is extremely important, I would say. In your workplace, instead of just automatically shooting an email to somebody down the hall, get up and walk down the hall and talk to them face-to-face. Find out what's going on in their lives, and it'll make you more productive as well. So a lot of people look at that as a waste of time. But in terms of solving complex or nuanced problems, there's nothing, the research says, like the face-to-face. And finally, I would just say the final suggestion is to always consider it when making plans for your kids' education. So less emphasis on gadgets, more emphasis on face-to-face interaction and the quality of teaching.
Awesome. Susan Pinker, thank you so much for being with us. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Yes, I think my final thought would be that, you know, digital technology is great for sharing information, but it's not as great for human connection and establishing trust. So when you have the choice, get out there and form bonds and make those habits where you see people in person when at all possible.
And hug a lot.
I think I'm all for that.
Well, Susan, I appreciate you being with us today. I know listeners can find out more about the work you're doing in the book at susanpinker.com, susanpinker.com. The book we've talked about today, of course, The Village Effect, how face-to-face contact can make us healthier, happier, and smarter. And it's a really interesting read and makes you look at things differently, which I think is always a sign of a book well done. If you have questions or comments on today's show on either of our segments, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617, or you can email me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net. vickysaintclair.net. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair and on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I thank each of you for joining us today and spending this hour with us. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.